For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening. Welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to have with us tonight my old friend David Chadwick, who's the biographer of Suzuki Roshi, who was his teacher, founder of San Francisco Zen Center. David spoke about Suzuki Roshi yesterday. Tonight he's going to, well, we'll see what he talks about. But one of the things, in addition to writing Crooked Cucumber, in the Suzuki Roshi biography, he wrote a wonderful book called Thank You and OK, An American Zen Failure in Japan. So David has practiced extensively in and been involved in Zen practice in Japan and America, and I recommend that book as, besides being hilarious, one of the most insightful books on the differences between Japanese and American cultures. Anyway, David, welcome again to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. So glad you're here, and take it away.
Well, good evening. Good evening. Fellow followers of the way. Tygon suggested I start off talking about Japan and America, and sometimes my first thought when he said that was, gosh, you know, if I had questions about Japanese American practice, I'd probably call him, ask him what he thought, but I can't do that now because I've got to pay my way. And it's fun noticing the difference between different cultures, and of course we certainly do know it when we're involved with another culture, and tend to notice things that are irritating, are distinctive in the difference. Of course, when it gets down to it, of course, we're all just people, and that you really see that. Even if you're with people that are really, really, really different, at some point you see, oh, you know, there's some basic, you know, you get hungry and thirsty, and you have desires and, you know, likes and dislikes, and we're so, so very similar, all people. One thing that comes into play is, there's this old thing in China there was a prejudice that the northern Buddhists had against the southern Buddhists, and some idea that somebody from the south couldn't really understand Buddhism. There's a little bit of that in play. I mean, a lot of people in Japan, of course, are very, very ethnocentric, just like Americans are, and think of Buddhism as being something Japanese for Japanese. Your average Japanese thinks of Buddhism as being a memorial service, a funeral service, something for ceremonies. But when you get into temples and people that are practicing and meditating, then it gets more similar. But there's a professor, John Nelson, University of San Francisco, asked me to come to his class one day, and he uses Thank You and OK as one of his textbooks for his Zen class, which I like. And anyway, he was doing this slideshow and he asked me to comment just as things went by. And there was one of the slides went up was a quote. It was between D.T. Suzuki and Hisamatsu. They were both, Japanese Buddhists who were professors in Boston. One of them was at Harvard and one was at MIT. I guess him as Isamatsu was at MIT. I can't remember. I don't know. And they were both with the Elsie Mitchell's Cambridge Buddhist Society in the 50s. And anyway, the quote was, have you ever met a Westerner? You know, one of them says to the other, have you ever met a Westerner who understood what we're talking about? No, I haven't. Me either. Something like that. He wanted to know what I thought. I think it was a case of, you know, nobody from the South can understand. Only us Northerners can. But I wasn't surprised to read that. I thought, yeah, well, of course we can't understand. We're not Japanese. I have a friend that spent, decades in Japan. He's teaching Zen in America now. And I was visiting him inside a little sub-temple inside the very famous Ryoanji, right? Where the stones are, that's what it's called. And he was trimming the hedges there. And he read Japanese newspapers. He'd been there so long. And, you know, he said, you know what it gets down to? He said, just telling them what they expect to hear. So you'll always run into that sort of thing in religion. And really the ultimate, I mean, there is the thing with, you know, having a teacher and having the teacher recognize your understanding and passing on the teacher that way. You need some sort of verification. But also there's the thing about really you're also the ultimate teacher. I mean, all that Buddhism is doing is it's just this elaborate system of hints of many, many different types, and everybody's got their own way of doing it and trying to wake us up to who we are, trying to wake us up to reality. And you know, nobody can do it for us. I was at Zen Center, and there was a 50th anniversary of Shunryu Suzuki's coming to America. We always call Suzuki Roshi. And one of the senior priests there was a disciple of his, said, with Japanese priests in the audience, that Suzuki Roshi came to America because, I think I said this yesterday, something like this, because moss was growing on the branches of Buddhism there. And you know, of course, there's the thing about beginner's mind, and he said it was so great to have students who didn't have all these assumptions about Buddhism. And so anyway, there was some idea like that we had this is our way of being the North and them being the South. Our idea was that, we have this fresh new approach and we've got beginner's mind and they're all encumbered by all these, you know, all the trappings of religion and everything, and they're all held down. But even though, as we say when we chant the Heart Sutra, that there's no obstacle, and I really think that's true, still, obstacles are endless that there are none of. You know, like Gilbert Radner used to say, it's not one thing, it's another. And so I don't, you know, he really didn't mean to say that we've got superior practice here. I'm sure it was a relief to him, though, not to have to deal with all sorts of assumptions. But actually, he ran into a lot of assumptions here that had been put in everybody's mind from reading Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki and all the very Enlightenment-oriented materials that had come here, which also had served a very valuable and continue to serve a valuable function. And you know, the work that Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki did early on is wonderful, and we wouldn't be sitting here without them, or we wouldn't be sitting the same way. Maybe through some other avenue we'd all be here practicing, but maybe the room would be turned around, we'd be in a different direction or something. You know, one thing, like, you go to Japan, it's better not to tell people you're interested in Buddhism. Because, like I said, well, several things. One, it's, they have some idea, oh, you're just coming over here to just sort of play with it, you know. You're not really serious. And a lot of people, something you run into over and over over there is, you know, they're really serious. But, oh, these, you know, the monks here, they're just interested in getting money for their ceremonies and, you know, drinking and having parties at night or, you know, dinner parties. And they're not really sincere. The only sincere ones are the ones that are up there in the mountains with, you know, with the snow coming in the windows that are getting beaten with sticks. There's really a very strong idea like that. And I cited a Rinzai temple mainly in Japan. I was at both times, but I was, you know, like a short time in one, a longer time at the other. And every Sunday, I lived next door with my wife and me. And, you know, we had jobs and stuff, but I practiced with them at the temple too. And on Sunday at the temple where I was, like 100 lay people would come sit, which was, you know, there's little zazen groups all over Japan. They tend to be like once a week or once a month. And but two of the monks from the temple would come there every day and hit every single person. It's like a lot of Japanese, they don't feel like they've really been to the temple if they haven't been hit. And, you know, there's no other Buddhist country that does that. And, like, somebody was talking about being in Bodh Gaya, you know, where there's every Buddhist country has its temple there, and people will go check them out, and they'll go to the Japanese and see people, they're hitting them. I mean, what is this about? So, anyway, you know, I could go on forever talking about the little differences like that. Of course, one of the enormous changes have happened because of Buddhism coming to America. I mean, the Buddhist teachers that came to America, like Suzuki Roshi and Yasutani and Soen and Maizumi and Kudo, that's the one who was in New York that Scheinberg wrote about, who's very interesting. They're different ones. They came to teach, you know, zazen and practice and whatever they learned. They were like bringing monastic practice to lay people, and I don't know what they had in mind, but what's happened here is that there's been a sort of transference of monastic practice, not only from Zen either, but from Tibetan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism into lay life. And Buddhism here is with, you know, there's many exceptions and gradations, but is so much of it is sort of monastic practice being implemented in people's lay life, being integrated into their lives, and a very strong idea of having some sort of sitting practice, and then bringing that. Understanding into your everyday life in different ways, which each of us uses our brilliant minds to figure out different ways to practice, and you know, figure out what does that mean. You know, you hear the word practice, and it's just like water torture after a while. Of course, one of the enormous differences is the number of women who, you know, already, I mean, but it hadn't been that long. It's just, you know, in the last 100 years, the whole story practically, there are the 150 years, but, you know, the last 50 years, most of it, a very high percentage of priests and teachers and administrators and everything in Buddhism in America and all the different levels are women in the Western control. It's going to take them a little longer in the Asian control because they've, you know, the men and women have different roles like in these other countries. And women are having a big effect on Tibetan Buddhism. And boy, that's maybe one of the that might be the most intransigent one. But also just the number of Jewish teachers there are. I mean, that certainly never happened before. it's that's really striking. It's a very, very high percentage. So the meaning of East and West, we're experiencing that, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization going on. And it's, you know, we're, to me, all beings are practicing, all beings are have some sort of meditation. I don't really know what's happening in the animal world, but in the human world, you know, you can watch like cats, what is it? Joe Camilla used to do that biofeedback stuff. He said sleeping cats had theta waves, which are sort of your deep meditation waves. But I think we're all beings on a spiritual path, and then we become more conscious of it when we get involved in something like this. And each of us in our own way tries to, you know, make it real and wake up and, you know, just, it's a very difficult thing to do. I know they say, you know, they say it's easy, and then they'll say it's difficult. I love in Shogyal Rinpoche's Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which I read like twice to Ananda when he was sort of paralyzed and cranky and before he died in this convalescent home. I read it sort of like twice, skipped over some of some parts the second time. But in there, Shogyal Rinpoche says, why is it if you know, all there is Dharmakaya, if all there is Buddha, if that's our reality and everything else is illusion, why, and if it's, you know, it's right here, why is it that it's so hard to understand? And he said, in Tibetan Buddhism, we have the four somethings, the four white's hard to standings, why it's hard to understand, the four difficulties or something like that. And the first one is because it is so close. And of course, that word in is used in Buddhism a lot, and it's translated as close or intimate. It's so close that we overlook it. And the second reason is that it's so subtle that we just wouldn't guess that anything could be that subtle. And the third reason is that it's so profound that it is difficult to imagine. You can't. It's a profundity beyond imagining, beyond any startlingly profound. And the last one is so wonderful that we wouldn't imagine that the ultimate reality would be so wonderful. You know, my conviction is that, though, that it is also inevitable, which is something that Buddha said, that we will wake up to who we are and what reality is. And I think it's good to persevere and to try to develop some sort of seamless practice. And it's, you know, it's not good to say something that you're not willing to do yourself, but I actually have always tried to have a seamless practice. But I get distracted sometimes. And I think you should realize that the wisdom comes from you, and that you also will not only be getting hints and clues and guidance from teachers, fellow students, and books, but you'll be getting it from your own higher consciousness, from your, or whatever we call it, no matter what word we use for what we are, or, you know, it won't be right. I can keep saying things like this, but somebody might have a question that could possibly put us on another course. Yes.
Yeah. Could you say a little more about what you mean by seamless practice?
Well, it's already too late. The minute has passed. Here it is again. Let's see. I think that's just for each of us to figure out. You know, it's all just for us to figure out. It's one reason why people work on koans and have mantras, because silent illumination or shikantaza, the idea of just sitting, just doing what you're doing, and that incidentally is the Jesuits' motto: is do what you're doing. Same idea. And ultimately, I think that's the highest practice, is just to be who you are. I mean, nothing Suzuki Roshi said more than, I don't think, just be yourself. There's the idea of, and this might relate to the seamlessness. Now, he's not adding something, and he would say that a lot. Don't stick to some idea. He and Trungpa both said, don't go on any trips. And what is that doing? There's an old Chinese saying that Suzuki Roshi used to quote, is you can ride a horse, but you can't ride a horse on a horse. Now, of course, we know that because of the wonders of television in the modern age, that you can ride a horse on a horse, because they're giant horses, little horses. Somebody could do it, you know. And there was a college science class about 40 years ago made a soap burst out of sow's ears. But almost always you can't ride a horse on a horse. And what does that mean? You can ride a horse, but you can't ride a horse on a horse. Well, that was his teaching, that we have one of the miracles of life. He said the miracles of life is that you get just enough problems. The problems you get are problems that you can solve. And I know another teacher that says that that's the nature of existence. That's the sort of magical cosmic nature of existence, that the problems we are presented with, you know, the things that bother us, the things we want to solve, whatever, are things that we can solve. But we complicate this with our neurotic thinking. And that is putting a horse on a horse. In other words, we can deal with the problem we've got, but then we add to it with this other problem, you know, with or whatever. That's the way I interpret stones in the air, too, which he used. And I've heard other interpretations of that. But I think that's what he meant, is imaginary problems. And all our problems are ultimately imaginary. I mean, even very, very terrible things. In the light of the immediate reality, everything dissolves. And we can deal with whatever comes to us. I remember talking to, I was just in India for a few months this year, and something, when I did civil rights work in Mississippi, oh, incidentally, another thing I want to brag about is I was here in Chicago, for those of you who weren't here Sunday, in 1964 with SDS. And that's what I always think. Students for a Democratic Society, we were saving the world from capitalism and imperialism.
Thanks for doing that.
Yeah. That's why we live in this participatory democracy where we all share everything equally. God, I can't remember what was I saying.
You're talking about stones in the air or something.
Oh, stones in the air. Yeah. Well, that's just the idea that his teacher gave him a calligraphy that had stones in the air. But that's imaginary problems. Creating problems with their mind, all problems being mind created. And Buddha was asked, where did everything come from? He said, everything is mind created. There is no creator other than mind. But I don't know. I mean, that didn't really do justice to explaining what seamlessness is. But I don't know, you know. If you figure it out, you tell me. Next.
David, you were to say something about being in India?
Being what?
In India.
Oh, in India. I was going to say I met Dr. Raman. I can't remember that first name. Ramanathan, something. Dr. Lohia, who founded the Indian Socialist Party and worked with Gandhi. He told me about being. He spoke to a group of us in the house, about 15 of us, that were doing civil rights work in Mississippi. And he told me about being. Later, I talked to him privately for a while about being tortured by the British, and he said he discovered there was nothing he couldn't withstand. I think that's true of life. Of course, fear is a big deal for beings that are born. And because, you know, we're afraid of death and pain and this and that. I think you will find that you can. There's nothing you cannot withstand. There's no problem you can't deal with, and that includes the problem of who are you or what is this. But that, yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing I had forgotten because I got off on some tangents. Yes, sir.
It's just maybe because something I read on the Huffington Post today. I guess there's some psychological scientific study that we're much less unhappy than we think we're going to be. That was like the headline. Meaning that they ask people, like, what are you afraid of, basically? And how unhappy do you think you're going to be when, you know, you lose your job or your girlfriend breaks up with you or whatever? And then I guess they followed up, and these things actually came to pass, as they often do. The people were much less unhappy. They were more okay with it than they expected to be.
Hmm.
And so the whole sort of thing was about this sort of self-righting mechanism of our minds, that we actually are really quite resilient beings, much more than we may have been. I thought it was nice.
I read the Huffington Post. I missed that today. Oh, yeah, there's some, you know, I see people who I know having little Bob Lou Richmond has a lot of stuff on the Huffington Post. And the woman who wrote Fire Monks, you know, she's going into the practice period at Tassajara, but she had stuff on it. Yeah, it's all right. You know, I look at people sometimes and then I get this one hit. I'll go, oh, poor so-and-so. I hope they're all right or blah, blah, blah. And I think, you know, look at yourself. I mean, it doesn't bother you who you are. It doesn't bother them who they are. They probably feel fine about it. And we adjust. And children, I mean, think of all the horrible things that children go through. And most people come out okay and surviving. But the important thing is not, I mean, for, talking about Buddhism, the important thing isn't just to survive or just to be happy or adjusted or anything like that. It's to wake up to ultimate reality. So, I mean, Buddhists and people who are practicing the way in any religion will often shake up their happiness or their security or whatever to try to, you know, to awaken. Yes.
I wonder if you could talk about being in the same room as Suzuki Roshi.
Well, it's just like being in here with you. Really. You know, he was a very beautiful person. He was a very charming person. He was a person that empowered people. And people liked to be with him. And he had this really, I mean, he did have a remarkable ability. I don't know if you call it an ability. He had a remarkable presence. But his presence wasn't like a something that knocked you over as much as it was just very, you know, he was very humble, you know. He was just himself. And he was always, responsive to others and kind and friendly. Teachers don't have to be that way, you know. He had a very positive, pleasant, charming way of teaching. Unless you got really close to him, then he could be a little meaner. But he's not that bad even then. I must say he's the most popular person I ever met. The disparate, the incredible variety of people that were around him, all these characters and people who didn't get along with each other, and people had very different approaches, you know, and angry people and all sorts of stuff, you know. Each one of them feeling that he understood, I mean, this is not exaggerated, but people, almost everybody felt that they felt that a very close personal tie to them, felt he really understood them, that he really appreciated them and believed in them and that sort of thing. He had attained something, some understanding. He'd awakened to something that was very palpable, you know. And he just really didn't do much of anything. He'd just be standing there. He was really not outgoing. He didn't say much in meetings. And I think about that sometimes, you know, how much happened because of his being here for 12 years. We're starting talking the difference between Japan and America. In his own country, he wasn't getting anywhere. Nothing was happening. He didn't have any disciples. There's an old saying in India. I don't know how many people said it. It's such a big country. But it was, you should study with a teacher who lives at least two valleys away. I read that once. So he had to go to another valley to be appreciated. But I think he needed to go over here also to sort of ripen himself. He had that ability to learn from his surroundings. And he was always growing and learning. He was by no means perfect. Tiger was saying to me the other day, somebody was saying, oh, Suzuki Roshi knew just what he was doing. What, in appointing Dick Baker, successor? Yeah. And sometimes I'll hear people say something like it, it's, oh, he knew just what he was doing. Well, I don't, you know, I think he had confidence. And yeah, I think he was doing his best and had confidence with, but mainly was acting intuitively. I don't think he had some magical ability to see through things and see the future. I mean, he just wasn't that type of person. But he had confidence that if he just did his best, and that, you know, things would turn out, and, you know, he would give it his best shot, and he had confidence that he'd keep that, you know, the Buddhist ball rolling, or whatever we'd say. But, yeah, it was very inspiring to be around him. But, you know, Zen Center grew more after he died than when he was alive. People stayed longer after he died than they did while he was alive. He wasn't in really good health, and he couldn't see people a lot. He tended to be more around him some, and you know, you'd hope to get one Dokusan with him in a year. Begu Roshi, Zen Center, Begu Roshi. Well, and he did this while Suzuki was alive too. He, you know, created a institution that gave people a lot to do. And until we got Tassajara, I remember Jerome telling me when I first came, sort of scared me, got me a little depressed. He said, "Oh yeah, you're all enthusiastic now, but you'll probably be gone in 2 years. Nobody stays over 2 years, you know." I went, "Oh," but people started staying longer. That's one reason, I think, why we have ceremonies and robes and positions, and why there's all the culture around religion. You know, we can't just have... We can't all be like following Krishnamurti's way. I stay in the Krishnamurti house in Chennai, and I love it. But they're just, you know, they're literally against anything. You know, like, no teaching, no gurus, no institution. They've got an institution and a guru, though. But, you know, and, you know, no hocus pocus, no statues, no special clothes, no blah, blah, blah. And that's okay. And for a lot of people, that is very appealing. It's appealing to me. I like it. I like to be around. It's very intellectual, and it's a wonderful place. And Chennai is not a entirely charming everywhere. And that's a really nice little center. Ah, love staying there. But, you know, when I look at the Tibetans, they have got so much that holds them together, my God, and they believe so much. You cannot keep up with all the stuff they believe. It's real. And to me, belief is just, you know, the purpose of religion is to help us drop our beliefs. That's why a lot of people don't like the word religion, you know. You know, I mean, it's not a religion, it's a way. It's not a way, it's a philosophy. You know, it's not a philosophy, you know. But I don't have a negative idea of the word religion, because I was raised on a sort of cosmic consciousness, mind-only type of transcendental Christianity, or something that I always appreciated. So I don't really know what religion means. I think of it as meaning relinking, bringing back heaven and earth together, you know. You know, one thing, like I was saying, I think we can have confidence in our practice, and I think we can have confidence that we can relink or awaken our, you know, there's that thing in the Bible or something, I ask and it'll be answered. I've really found that to be true. If I take something that I go, I really don't understand that, I don't know what you mean by that, and I just, you know, sort of keep working on that, you know, at some point I feel like I have come to some understanding of it. I've noticed that. And I noticed that just sort of organically in my life. I went, wow, I remember when that phrase or that idea or that aspect of teaching I used to go, whoa, I'll never understand that. But you're capable of understanding anything. Was it Bodhidharma said in one of Bill Porter Red Pine's wonderful translations? There's no Buddha that didn't get there through greed, hate, and delusion. Yeah. You keep almost asking something. It sounded like it.
No, I was just kind of...
Really?
Just kind of appreciating what you're saying. But maybe somebody else has a question. David.
Maybe you could just say a little bit about how you originally came to Zen Center and what led you there.
Well, I had this background I mentioned, which is very different than most people who came to it, where I grew up in a sort of what I call a mind-only type religion. And then I felt a strong yearning, a pull, a tug when I was a teenager toward something. I didn't know what. I knew I didn't want to go to college. I knew I wanted to get out. I wanted to hitchhike. I wanted to find something. I didn't know what. I sort of look back on that and go, that's interesting. And, I did this sort of, this civil rights work. I just sort of dabbled in it, a lot long, half a year, and SDS stuff. And then I came more of a hippie, semi-hippie, and living in Mexico, and discovered the wonders of marijuana, which I was sure that was it. then I discovered the LSD, and I took LSD and psychedelics like religiously. I studied the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and meditated, and fasted, had profound experiences, and thought, "Wow!" I thought that is profound. But I realized, thank goodness, that continuing to take psychedelics forever was not the way to investigate what I had had. I think of psychedelics as being an initiation, and I think psychedelics ought to be a part of culture, they are in shamanistic cultures. But when you make it illegal and you don't, you've got these wonderful tools for that can be used for an initiation. People, hey, guess what? There's more than you that you know. But then you make it all illegal and throw people in cages for being involved with it. And then young people who don't have initiations, they self-initiate. And then they don't know when to stop the initiation. But I thought I needed to find a group to meditate with and a guru or that sort of thing. I ended up going to San Francisco and running into the Zen Center, and I liked that. I liked it. And Suzuki Roshi wasn't there when I went, but Katagiri Roshi was there, and I decided to sit every day for a year. And I said, twice a day, man, I would not miss it. But I'd only been there a short while when we bought Tassahara, and then I went down there. And that was lucky. Wow. Yeah, good timing. But I see the whole universe, us all, as just one interconnected being, and I think we're just watching something that's happening, and we think we're doing it, and we keep telling our, and this is not an original thought, this is what neurologists are getting into. They're looking at the way the brain works and how they see the decision to do something happening after the movements to do it and stuff like that. And I love things like that. I love to look at existence. Because I don't think existence is one thing. I think it's like imaginary, and it just can be looked at in any number of different ways, and none of them are ultimately true. So I like to just, look at it that way, We're sort of telling ourselves a story about something that's already happened as if we did it, and we're just sort of experiencing it. I like that. That's sort of humbling. I like humbling interpretations.
Jim, did you have... No. Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I lived a couple blocks away, and about 3 or 4 years ago, I think, I came over here, and a gentleman talked about the... Soki Gaki. I mispronounced it for effect. Soki Gaki was a saying that they...
Soka Gakai.
Thank you. They said that, and that was the kind of the essence for practice. And then there's another...
Soka Gakai, Nami Moho Renge Kyo.
On the internet, I went on there, and there's a Shin Buddhism. And
yeah.
They have a stamp.
Nami Amida Butsu.
They have a heaven. Kind of.
Yeah.
And the... the other items of, well, it's starting to get me thinking here. Are all the, yeah, there's Zen, and in Japan, is there class differences in the Buddhist practice? I wonder, you know, it's like a tree called Buddhism, and they got the, do they all have the same food in order to, you know, all they all have after Soka Gakkai or something?
Yeah. Right. That's Nichiren Buddhism.
Pyramid. That was it.
Well, the Nichiren is the Soka Gakkai, it's part of Soka Gakkai. And the Pure Land is a lot closer to Zen, and Zen and Pure Land have had a lot of cross fertilization. D.T. Suzuki wrote as much about Pure Land as he did. He wrote about Jodo Shinshu, which is the Jodo Shinshu is called sometimes called the Arigataika Koro, which means grateful mind. Whereas the original Pure Land was Onigaika Koro, which means asking mind. Onigai means please save me. And then Shinran came along and said, no, thank you, I'm already saved. I like Jodo Shinshu a lot. The Soka Gakkai, that's the sort of, what would you call it? That's like the social, political arm of Nichiren Shoshu.
One aspect of Nichiren. It's one of the different schools within the Nichiren trend.
It tends to be associated a little more with fanaticism. But Nichiren is one of the old sects of Buddhism in Japan. And Soka Gakkai, you get associated with chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo for money and to get your new car and stuff. But it goes deep, too. And I've known Zen priests that got in that loved Nichiren and would do that, too.
Thank you.
But, you know, these things help you concentrate. Anything that helps you concentrate is good. And saying Nam-myoho Butsu, homage to Amida Buddha, all the time, that's not a bad thing to do.
So even though I teach, try and encourage, as you were saying, silent illumination, just sitting, open-minded zazen, I also encourage people, there are some people in our Sangha who do Nam-myoho Butsu during zazen, and some who do Nam-myoho Renge-kyo during zazen, and, anything that helps you to settle is good, is okay.
I've used practices like that a great deal, and I think they're good for people like me with like really busy minds. So have we come to that point at which we say goodbye, or are we approaching it?
Approaching. We have our final chant for the four Bodhisattva vows, but I wonder if anybody else has one more question who hasn't said anything yet.
Yes,
Joe.
I was wondering if you could speak about Katagiri Roshi.
Well, Katagiri Roshi was a very, very important teacher, and he's somewhat forgotten in the he was very important at Zen Center while Suzuki Roshi was alive and after Suzuki Roshi died. And he was dying to get out and have his own temple, and he eventually did, and everybody wanted him to stay, and Suzuki Roshi wanted him to stay, but he wanted his he had his own lineage, and he wanted to he wanted to have his own temple, and he went to Monterey, and then he went to Minneapolis, and we were very, very lucky to get him. Almost never got into any trouble, and that's something we were very lucky with Suzuki and Katagiri. Toward the end of his life, he had a couple of brief affairs that made his group send out letters announcing it to everyone. He felt a great disappointment that he died so young and that he couldn't have achieved more. And he would tell me that he was disappointed with the development of his group in Minneapolis, and that he wished it could be bigger. You know, what he saw happening around Suzuki was just unduplicable. Suzuki had a sort of charisma that Katagiri didn't have. But Katagiri was a good teacher to study with, and a lot of people realized that. And he actually did have a lot of students and did rather well. He just didn't have the amazing success Suzuki had. But he was, you know, he had that that devotion to duty and to practice in that, you know, that he just stuck with it. And, you know, he was there every zazen, and he was a great example. And he was always, he didn't have any arrogance, and he at all. Neither one of them did. And that's not true of all Japanese priests. And neither one of them had any stink of Zen, you know. They weren't too holy or anything. And he was always fun to be around, and you know, he was a great encouragement to everybody.
He was also really funny.
Yeah.
You know, he would talk about not sticking your head into things, and he would, when he talked about himself, he would say stinky Katagiri and point at his nose. He was a funny guy.
Yeah. Yeah.